Hello, and welcome to the Indiana Lawyer Podcast, your source for news in Hoosier law, brought to you by Taft. I'm Alexa Schrake, Indiana Lawyer reporter, and your host this week. As always, I'm here in our Monument Circle studio with managing editor Daniel Carson and our newest reporter, Mara Johnson. We are here to give you the rundown on the latest legal news. Plus, I chatted with Democratic Representative Ed Delaney and Republican Allie Bartlett, a partner at Bowes McKinney & Evans LLP, to recap this year's legislative session. So, let's get started. Today is Wednesday, March 20th, 2024, and these are your headlines. Daniel, how about you start us off with some news from litigation in a Marion County court involving Tesla?
A Marion Superior Court jury awarded an Avon man more than $42 million for serious injuries he suffered in a 2017 motorcycle crash with a pickup truck driven by a Tesla Incorporated employee. The jury returned the verdict Wednesday against Tesla and its longtime employee, Kyle Kasuba, for the accident in which motorcyclist Chris Dugan was severely injured. The jury found Kasuba 70% responsible for the accident and Dugan 30% responsible. The 2017 collision occurred in the 6300 block of Rockville Road when Kasuba, a Tesla service manager, made a left turn in the Tesla-owned Ford Super Duty F-250 maintenance truck across double yellow lines and two lanes of incoming traffic, according to court records. Dugan suffered a severe and permanent traumatic brain injury and a partial foot amputation. Nick Rowley, a trial attorney representing Dugan and a co-founder of Trial Lawyers for Justice, told Indiana Lawyer it was, quote, hands down a $60 million verdict, end quote, for Dugan, with the award amount reduced due to Dugan being found by the jury to have 30% comparative fault. Rowley said he expects the verdict to be appealed. He said the trial was the first Indiana case to be televised nationally by Courtroom Viewed Network. In the original lawsuit, it was alleged that Kasuba was operating the truck in the scope and course of his employment and or with the express permission of Tesla, which the complaint described as vicariously liable for Kasuba's negligence. According to court records, Dugan, 37, was on his way to work when the crash happened.
Moving on to the appellate bench, the Indiana Judicial Nominating Commission will be accepting applications this year for two vacancies on the Indiana Court of Appeals as two veteran judges retire. Judge Patricia Riley will step down this summer after serving on the state's second highest court since 1994, when she was named by then Governor Evan Bayh. She was previously served as Jasper Superior Court Judge. Judge Terry Crone plans to retire this fall. He has been on the court since 2004 after being appointed by then Governor Joe Kernan. He was previously the judge of St. Joseph Circuit Court. Riley and Crone both represent northern Indiana, so their successors will have to come from the 20 counties in the northern part of the state. Quote, combined, they have nearly 100 years of legal experience. We are incredibly grateful for their service to the judicial branch. We need your help to fill these vacancies, the Indiana Supreme Court wrote in a letter to the judicial officers and bar members of the 20 eligible counties. The application for Riley's vacancy on the bench is now open. Applications for Crone's vacancy will open at a later date. Quote, our colleagues on the Supreme Court and Court of Appeals join us in urging you to consider applying or to encourage your best and brightest colleagues to apply for these vacancies, the High Court wrote. Back to you, Daniel. You have some news related to January 6th.
A pair of Indiana men were arrested on felony and misdemeanor charges for allegedly assaulting law enforcement officers and other behavior during the breach of the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Donald Lee Moss, 62, of Elizabethtown, and James Link Bamer, 61, of Hope, were charged in a criminal complaint filed in the District of Columbia with felony offenses of civil disorder and assaulting, resisting, or impeding certain officers. The U.S. Department of Justice announced the two men are also charged with several misdemeanor offenses, including entering or remaining in any restricted building or grounds, disorderly or disruptive conduct in a restricted building or grounds, disorderly conduct in a Capitol building or grounds, and parading, demonstrating, or picketing in a Capitol building or grounds. After a physical confrontation during the riot with police, the two men climbed a staircase to the Upper West Terrace and entered the Capitol building via the Senate wing doors. The two men then made their way to the Capitol crypt and later exited the Capitol. At about 2:48 p.m., rioters broke through a barricade set up by Capitol Police at the Senate wing doors. Roughly 2 minutes later, Moss and Boehmer re-entered the Capitol again via the Senate wing doors and walked toward the crypt before exiting again at 3:34 p.m. The FBI arrested the men in Indiana. The two made their initial appearances in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Indiana. Now, Mara, what can you tell us about the latest developments in a Marion County murder case?
An Indianapolis man has been convicted of murder for his role in the shooting death of a man in 2021. Marion County Prosecutor Ryan Mears announced Daniel Rhodes was convicted for the July 2021 shooting of Michael McDowell. Rhodes was found guilty of murder with a habitual offender sentencing enhancement. On July 3, 2021, McDowell was found dead from a single gunshot wound at an apartment in the 10,000 block of Pine Needle Court. Prior to the shooting, witnesses said Rhodes and McDowell were visiting the apartment and that Rhodes was acting paranoid and under the influence. During a search warrant for Rhodes' residence, investigators found the rifle used in the shooting with Rhodes' DNA on it. Rhodes admitted to detectives that he shot McDowell in the head inside the apartment. He told police he thought he was being set up for a robbery and that McDowell had a gun. Detectives found no gun on McDowell or in the apartment. Rhodes will be sentenced on April 12th at 11 a.m. Alexa, tell us about some of the latest bills that were signed by the governor after this year's short legislative session.
I've been following several bills this legislative session, and as it came to a close, the Indiana General Assembly passed and then Governor Holcomb signed a few child welfare bills into law. One of those new laws went into effect upon passage. House Enrolled Act 1310 creates concurrent planning in children in need of services cases if the child has been removed from the parent for at least 12 of the most recent 22 months at the time of a period case review. The second part of the bill provides that adverse action against a foster parent's license or removal of a child from the home of a foster parent, relative of the child, or de facto custodian on the basis that filing a notice with the court that a petition is required to be filed but has not been filed to terminate the parent-child relationship with regard to the child. Both Senate Enrolled Act 171 and House Enrolled Act 1101 will go into effect on July 1st. SEA 171 amends the circumstances in which reasonable efforts to reunify a child with the child's parent, guardian, or custodian, or preserve a child's family are not required. HEA 1101 establishes a safe baby court as a type of problem-solving court for children 3 years of age and younger in need of services. And finally, to wrap up this week's headlines, Mara, tell us what you are working on for our next print issue.
Governor Eric Holcomb signed a new House bill into law on March 12th, expanding the definition of revenge pornography in a state statute to include images generated by artificial intelligence. House Bill 1047 specifically targets the perpetrators who distribute the explicit photos, not the media platforms they're distributed on. I spoke to District 13 Representative Sharon Nagel, who says Indiana is one of many states adopting legislation to handle the expanding use of AI. In addition to expanding the revenge porn statute, House Bill 1047 also expands the definition of voyeurism to include the use of a concealed camera to capture intimate images. The bill also includes language to offer fair compensation to more than 700 Hoosiers who were victims of sexual abuse as Boy Scouts. You can read more about it in our March 27th print issue.
Okay, that'll do for this week's headlines. As always, if you want more legal news, check us out at theindianalawyer.com. Stick around after our sponsor break to hear my interview with Representative Ed Delaney and attorney Allie Bartlett.
Taft, today's modern law firm. At Taft, we cultivate a highly respectful, transparent workplace that fosters creativity, teamwork, inclusion, and diversity. We couple our culture with a client-first approach, rewarding lawyers who understand their clients' goals and work to deliver success. Taft, the modern law firm. To learn more, visit taftlaw.com.
I have with me today Democrat Representative Ed Delaney and Republican Allie Bartlett, partner at Bose, McKinney & Evans. The 2024 legislative session just came to a close, and Governor Eric Holcomb has been assigning several bills into law each day. It was a short session this year, but a lot happened. So to start, Ed, was this legislative session what you expected it to be?
No, We were misled into believing that we would do very little. And we did very little that was positive, but we did a few bad things and spent more time on them than I might have expected. So, you know, I think we were misled. Not that that ultimately matters.
Yeah. And Allie?
Yeah, I actually don't disagree that it maybe wasn't what I expected, but I do think that there were some positive outcomes. I think when I say it wasn't what I expected, I thought that there might be less that took place. Not that I think the stuff that passed was necessarily bad, but I think more happened than what we thought would up front.
And Ed, what do you consider to be, you know, the new laws that will be the most impactful, you know, to lawyers and the practice of law?
Yeah, I think there were two that are the most impactful. One was it got confused and maybe in a series of bills, but there was an attempt led by Senator Garton to completely disrupt the administrative law process that some lawyers are involved with, who handle administrative appeals, whether they're on fines or penalties or on new regulations, or whether regulations are temporary or permanent. So with a lot of litigation around the space or the topic of administrative law and regulations. And Senator Garton, I think he's transposed things and he thinks there's an administrative state in Indiana. So he's constantly pecking away at our administrative law code. And his, I think, made significant differences, changing the burden of proof, changing who can appeal or when they can appeal, who might have to pay fees and so forth. So he's in a series of related ways nipped away at our tradition. So I think it's going to take some years, literally, to figure out what these changes of burden of proof, burden going forward, how appeals are handled, who handles these cases. It'll take us probably years before we completely sort it out. And I think that's probably one of the biggest changes. The other change, which curiously got interlinked at the last moment, the other big law, was the one that is designed to clamp down on debate in universities and make sure the debate that their more conservative views are somehow represented. I'm not sure how this will be done. But curiously, in that bill, which has, I think, was the worst bill of the session, at the end, the Commission on Higher Education, which was going to be stuck with the task of dealing with the complaints from students or perhaps complaints from professors who lost tenure, or people who weren't hired because of this requirement that you be in some way balanced in your views. The Commission on Higher Education saw that train coming down the track, but God knows how many disputes, and got that shifted over to the administrative law judges. That is the very groups that Senator Garton has been trying to change all their rules. So I'm glad, I've always been glad that I'm not an administrative law judge, but I think that's totally true now.
Yeah. And Allie, what do you think?
So I agree on one point, which is that I think House Bill 1003 is probably the piece of legislation that is most impactful to the practice of law that came out of this session. I actually practice administrative law on a very regular basis as part of my legal practice. And I have to say that alternatively, I was very happy with the outcome of House Bill 1003. I think it goes along with the efforts that certainly Senator Garton and others in the legislature have undertaken over the last several sessions to make sure that our administrative agencies in the state of Indiana are doing what they're supposed to do, which is working for Hoosiers and working for the people of the state of Indiana. And so what House Enrolled Act 1003 does, Representative Delaney is correct, it changes the burden of proof basically on administrative agencies so that they have a higher threshold of evidence that they have to present in order to, you know, win a case when a Hoosier or a private company or something like that files a lawsuit essentially against an administrative agency. So what happens there is basically, you know, Hoosiers, private citizens, private corporations, anyone who's regulated by a state agency, if they think that they have received an outcome, a determination from a state agency that is wrong or illegal, they have one path to kind of combat that determination. And that is basically to sue the state. And when I'm representing clients before a state agency, it's really hard to sue an agency that regulates and licenses you. So I have clients that are licensed by state agencies. I work, you know, with various different state agencies. And even if they feel that they have a good case, it's really hard to think about suing the agency that regulates and licenses you. And so basically what this does is it changes that standard of proof so that the agency has more of a burden to bear to say, you know, we have made the right decision here in this case. And so it gives a greater opportunity to citizens or businesses to present their case and makes it more fair on both sides. You know, we have great state agencies in the state of Indiana that do a lot of good work. And so there probably shouldn't be a lot of concern on their side with this raised increased standard of proof. They can easily come up with those things because they're not embarking on frivolous lawsuits most of the time or, you know, frivolous decision-making. And so, you know, if we have faith in how our state agencies are operating, then there should be no problem here with the increased burden of proof. It also changes, like Representative Delaney mentioned, some provisions related to attorney's fees. So when you appeal these decisions, when you go through the administrative law process and there's a hearing with an administrative law judge, you can appeal all the way up to a process called judicial review. Prior to this legislation passing, there was no provision in the law where someone suing the state could recover any type of attorney's fees, even if they won. And so now if you win on judicial review, you have an opportunity to recover attorney's fees, which can actually be prohibitive for some people in pursuing what they think is justice because they had no opportunity before to recover attorney's fees that they would have paid for, even if they have a positive outcome at the end. So overall, the effort made in this bill was to say, you know, hey, we've got good state agencies in this state, but it may be really hard for people to pursue legal action, even if it's rightful. State agencies, if they're doing, you know, their job the way they're supposed to be, they should be able to meet the increased burden of proof. And number three, they should be able to recover attorney's fees from the state of Indiana if they have embarked on this rightful journey in this lawsuit. So that's 1003. I think it definitely is the biggest impact for the practice of law, especially those of us who practice in the administrative space. I do agree with Representative Delaney that it will take many years for us to see how this shakes out because some of the changes are pretty big. So it's going to be different, but I think overall it will be positive.
Not in total disagreement. I mean, first of all, let's be fair, people. I think Representative Sterwald, who, unlike Senator Garton, is a lawyer, that's very familiar in these procedures, did a very credible job of trying to make sure that we didn't go too far, that there was some balance left here. He deserves that. He was very open to suggestions. I'm among others with making suggestions. And still voted against it. But anyway, that's the nature of the game. But back to the merits, the one thing that I did discuss at length with the majority, and I think came out about right, was on the fees for attorneys. The way it's set up now, if the agency loses before the administrative law judge and the agency decides to appeal and it loses again now in the regular court system, that's probably the right time if they're going to get stuck with paying the fees for the citizen. That's probably the right time because the agency has made a policy decision. We had a regulation or we imposed a fine. We were taken before the administrative law judge. We lost. If they're going to appeal, it should not be out of anger or anything like that or frustration. It should be out of a policy decision that they think this decision that against them was destructive of the system somehow. So for that kind of a big reason they're appealing, turns out they're wrong. They lost on the what I think is largely a policy argument. I don't have a problem with their having to pay the fees, even though like most American lawyers, I don't like fee shifting, but this is a different category because of administrative law. One of my big concerns here was we made some really wonderful changes, again, largely with the leadership of Representative Sterwald on the structure. It used to be the agency had their own judge, they appointed the judge, and that judge decided on the appeals against their agency. We got rid of that a few years ago. And we're working our way through that. So to some extent, what I see happening and it happened here is those people who start down a path of administrative reform, they decide that every year they got to have another reform. I hope we have a pause because we've had two major reforms. One is to who will judge and the other is to how they will they weigh decisions and how the courts look at their decision. Those are big changes, and I hope we can just slow down and get some decisions made. It'll keep the courts busy. There'll be appeals. So yeah, I wish, you know, if you're an appellate lawyer, this is probably one of the greatest job creators in a long time. If you're an administrative lawyer, it may depend. We may have scared off some actions by the agencies, by these decisions. And that's my concern. I don't think we have a series of agencies in this state that are too aggressive. So we've basically told them, slow down, be more careful. Careful is good, but be more cautious. That's not so good. We don't have a reputation for being overly aggressive. And lying in the background here is the deal, especially like on the environmental area. If we don't do our job as a state, the feds take it over. That's the way it is. And that could happen if we go too far. If the courts go too far, we could find that we might find that the IDEM would, for example, have its regulatory powers moved down the hall, down the street to the federal building. I hope that doesn't happen. But anyway, this is a big topic. I'm glad this is being discussed here. I think it's of great interest to lawyers. It's also a great interest to the business community and to the public. And I hope that this conversation will settle down for a little bit of a while.
Yeah, I agree that it's going to be good to see how it shakes out and see the impacts as they move through the court system. And definitely agree, Representative, credit to Representative Sewerwald. And I think Senator Carrasco was involved and Senator Garten, of course. So yeah, I think there's been a lot on this and it will be really interesting to see how it plays out, you know, as appeals take place under this new system.
So the General Assembly, you know, passed several laws this year to help protect, you know, certain industries, including banking and trucking, you know, from certain kinds of lawsuits. Do you think, you know, this kind of tort reform is necessary?
I'll speak as a lawyer. I'm a retired lawyer, but I'll never stop thinking like one, I hope. I'm not sure these, the two changes that I think we may be talking about, one affected the trucking companies, owners of trucks, and whether they need to modernize their safety equipment. And the other one was on whether the fact that I wasn't wearing a seatbelt in my car when I had a wreck, whether that fact can be introduced. Historically, it's not been able to be introduced. I don't think those are tort reform in any broad sense. I think they're sort of small attempts at that kind of thing. So, you know, those are the two that I see that might fall into that category. The it's very interesting as a sort of not a scholar of legal history, but I've been around long, so I'm part of legal history, I guess, is the thing about not having to update your equipment now. As I understand the bill, if I have safety equipment in my truck when I buy it, I'm a truck company, I'm an owner of trucks. I have to maintain it. If there's a recall for safety equipment, I have to upgrade it. What I don't have to do under the bill is if some new advanced safety device becomes available, I cannot be held liable because I did not incorporate this new device. That's quite an interesting change, and it conflicts with something that we have historically, which is industry standards. So I don't know how that's going to work out in a case where if 98% of the trucking companies adopted a new upgraded safety device that could be put into the vehicle, and my company didn't. I don't know whether we're going to deal with this statute that says I don't have to upgrade, or we're going to deal with the more traditional common law view that industry standards are important, that a measure of negligence, part of the negligence standard is, are you reasonable? And if 90%, 98% are doing this change, and you're not, I think that's going to be an interesting debate. Someone, again, some appellate lawyer will make some money off of this one. But I think it's very important for the public, the safety standard. The seatbelt one, no pun intended, really, but that's been hanging by a thread for a long time. The idea that I could ask for damages when maybe my failure to take care of myself, this isn't the trucking company, this is me. I chose not to put my seatbelt on. And I got hurt more because of that. It's kind of tough to prove that, but if it were able to be proven, it's kind of hard to argue that I shouldn't be able to prove that now. Again, it's taken us, what, 50 or 60 years of seatbelts before we finally got to this point. But we got there. I don't think it's earth shaking, but in some cases it'll be important. If it's a big damage case and the driver was not wearing a seatbelt, I think the chances of settling are going to shift a little bit in the direction of the defendant away from the plaintiff.
Ali, do you have anything to add on that?
Yeah, no, I pretty much agree, I think. So I agree completely that I don't necessarily think I would raise these to calling these two things tort reform, but definitely agree on the point about the seatbelt and the shift of liability there. I mean, I don't necessarily think that is like some huge windfall benefit to the trucking companies. It's really just more of like an evidentiary change. And like Representative Delaney said, you know, if somebody is, that's tough to prove, but if you are actually able to prove that someone failed to wear their seatbelt, which that's a law. So if they didn't follow the law and then it resulted in a higher amount of damages, like why should that burden necessarily shift to a trucking company? So I think that makes perfect sense. On the side of the banking, the bill regarding the change in the banking space, that one is a bit different. So that one had to do, I think, with the standard or amount of time that a banking or a financial institution has to provide notice of certain changes to consumer contracts. And so I think what happened there, as far as I know, is that the banking and financial institution industry was having trouble keeping up with federal regulations that were changing in the timing windows that customers had to kind of like cancel their card or you know, cancel their account when those notices were provided. And so it's finding a balance between their requirements under federal law. And when I say they, I mean the banking industry. And then, you know, how much time consumers have to then cancel their account in response. And if you're talking to me as a consumer, like, do I sit there and read those notices that I get from my banking and financial institutions? No. And so do I understand that those companies are highly regulated by the federal government? Absolutely. And so am I really going to use a 30-day window anyway to like read the fine print? Probably not. And so I don't think this is going to have as many negative impacts as people really think. Like, I don't think there's going to be some slew of lawsuits against banks and financial institutions because that window has been shortened. I think it's more practical than people realize. It's more in order to allow those companies like easily comply with changes in federal regulation that they have to comply with. So I would probably look at it through that lens versus, you know, they're trying to trap consumers into these contracts. You still can cancel a contract. It just changes that timing window. So
yeah, the guts of this decision was to shorten the statute of limitations. Problems with your bank or financial and credit union or whatever that change the terms of your arrangement on your checking account, right, or your savings account. It gets a little more dicey because it seems to have some effect even on your mutual funds if you get them to your bank or credit union. That's a little more sensitive.
That's true.
And we got competing things going on here. The consumer doesn't want to be bothered by a notification that, you know, we changed the interest rate or the time for this, or this is how many days it is when you're late on your payment. All, you know, it's very interesting. The consumers don't want to be bothered. On the other hand, and here's where the rub is, if a bank or institution was making a pretty dramatic change and was caught within 3 years now, there'll be no claim. If they're caught within 2 years, there can be a claim. I think the real impact is going to be on the class actions. And I think that's, this was not publicly discussed, but I think that's the issue, where if a class action could be brought 4 or 5 years out, because some smart plaintiff's lawyer observes something being done by a particular bank or an industry, they won't be able to do that now, at least under our cases. They'll have a much shorter window. So that's sort of the dilemma. And part of this is the technology change and the attitude change. And you know, the day where you went into the bank and signed an account, actually had a written account agreement and knew what it looked like, it's gone. So we're trying to deal with it. And I think we were responding, as I recall, Ellie, you'll know this. I think there were two court decisions in Indiana that applied the longer statute of limitations. And so to get rid of the question, the legislature was asked to say 2 years, make it clear. And one of our jobs, one of our more interesting jobs at the State House, is to react to court decisions. This is a clear example of doing that. Since I love to tell stories, I got on the elevator one time right after the court came down with a decision about one of our most messed up statutes that amended for decades over and over, and I think it was messed. And I said to the judge, I think it was from the Supreme Court, I said, I saw your decision. And they said, well, what'd you think? I said, well, you got it wrong. And the judge says, well, here it comes. You're free to change it. That's exactly right. I mean, that was the judge's response. It was the right response. The legislature thinks they got it wrong, either for policy or because they didn't understand our intent. We can do it. And we did it here.
Yeah, absolutely. Because there is no legislative intent in the state of Indiana. So there's nothing to rely on. So only the legislature can respond in those cases. So yeah. I think that makes us kind of unique, too.
Yeah, it's kind of a law school test. A couple of these things are law school tests. I hope the law students are watching these things to understand
they're listening.
How it works. Yeah, the federal system is quite different.
But yeah.
We're in the state courts, and our state courts did something, and we're right down the hall from each other, and we move. It's just it's quite a contrast with the federal system.
It is. It is. And I think you're right, too, Representative, when you were talking about the class action impact. And I know Senator Baldwin brought that up in the course of discussion on this bill in, you know, some examples he had seen of like kind of predatory behavior, you know, by law firms that aren't even based in the state of Indiana, just kind of like using our laws to their advantage in the class action space. And I think this was probably partially a response to that as well.
You got that. I'm sure it was. I've done some class actions. I understand how this works out. It's very intriguing and something. I think there's some animosity towards class actions, which I think is overdone. I think they can provide a very useful purpose and have had some beneficial results. So we'll have to see how this works out in this case.
Do you think it was appropriate for the legislature to effectively kill a pending lawsuit by the city of Gary against gun manufacturers and sellers? Is it appropriate for the legislature to take action on pending lawsuits?
Well, since I'm always going first, I'll go first again. I find this offensive, inappropriate, shouldn't have been done. I think we, as a legislature, we pass laws and we see how they play out. It's not our job to get in the middle of a lawsuit and say, well, there's a law or a legal theory that allows this case to go forward and we don't like it, so we'll stop it. I think it's a very, very bad precedent for the legislature. I'm not sure what the courts will do. I think it's very, unfortunately, I hate this term, but it's a very, quote, interesting, end quote, legal issue as to whether, given the separation of powers under our state constitution, whether the legislature can reach into an individual lawsuit and try to determine the result. Now, the way we did it, of course, was by handing it over to the attorney general. He can pursue the case. He's publicly announced that he will never sue a gun company or a gun store. Okay. So we handed it off to somebody who was obviously not going to pursue it. If he doesn't, and I'm sure he will not pursue the suit, then we'll probably be going to the Supreme Court of the state of Indiana at some point to see whether the legislature can do this. Pretty remarkable. The hidden reality behind this is, in the first decade of this century, and then again in the second decade, the legislature passed bills designed to kill this lawsuit. And we missed. We shot two blanks because the court said, you didn't get it done. The lawsuit's still alive. Well, we tried the third time. I hope it's another blank.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. So doing this is not unprecedented. This has happened before, but I think, you know, there's two things at play here, which is a question about local control, which I think there's an argument to be made for local control in situations like this. But if I'm looking at the other side, and I think there is another side here, especially on this topic in particular, it's the state interest in a matter like of this significance. And so I think the effort here is related to solidifying the state's interest in a topic like this, because the legislation that passed was specific to this topic, gun manufacturers. And so, again, we have to see how this plays out because we don't know. This is something that's going to be continue to be litigated. And whether, you know, this litigation continues or if there is litigation on this particular bill, I don't, you know, we'll see, but it's going to have to play out. And I think objectively, those are the two arguments there. It's local control versus a state interest. I think there are arguments on both sides. So I'm not really taking one or the other. I'm just saying I think there are arguments on both sides. I can see validity in both, and it will be interesting to see how it plays out in the court system.
And the local control is an interesting subplot here because the theory of the case, the city of Gary, in effect, is saying that the activity of gun manufacturers in certain, shall we say, bad boy gun stores worked to create more crime, more murder, more deaths in their community because they were making available weapons to people who should not have had the weapons for whatever reason. And that falls right into the old nuisance theory. I mean, not every bar is a nuisance. A drunk could walk out of every bar, but if there's a bar that has a lot of drunks walking out, it has a lot of traffic accidents, a lot of fights, it can be called a nuisance. We had this idea for a long time. So if a gun store in cooperation with a manufacturer was basically providing a market for guns for people who were either not permitted to or had shown an ability to be violent, why can't we go after them? Especially when Gary's theory would be, and quite rightly, because of the nature of its urban nature and its proximity to Chicago, that it was a more likely place. You're not likely to have that kind of a nuisance store in some small town far from the borders of the state. So treating all cities the same and saying that Gary couldn't address what it thought was its problem or Indianapolis couldn't address what it thinks is its problem, and that the attorney general has to decide whether something's a nuisance. This attorney general is not interested in making that decision, but the office as a whole has not had that function. So I think it's the dilemma is the case is already close to 25 years old, if I've got it right. And we'll now have 5 years going to the Indiana Supreme Court, assuming the attorney general decides to kill the case off. So this is far from swift justice.
So our last question for the podcast, it looks like the legislative leaders punted several issues this year that will set them up for a very busy session in 2025, addressing the Medicaid funding hole, considering major tax reform, and explaining the state's road funding formula all appear to be on the table. You know, what do both of you see happening in the legislature next year?
Wow. Well, I have the fortune or misfortune of being on the tax committee that wanted to study tax system. There was no testimony that got it was in favor of repealing the sales of the income tax, maybe some tweaks. Even the most conservative national organizations came in to say that our tax rates are reasonable, our structure functions. The property tax is the tougher one because it affects so many people, the homeowners, and then, of course, anybody who has property, not just homeowners. And it's incredibly complex. We could make changes to it that would have the impact of lowering property taxes. That would be the desired goal. But then we're going to have a shift over to other taxes, or we're going to have to undercut local governments who are heavily dependent, including school districts, heavily dependent on property taxes. So I think that's going to be the tough nut in that category of the group of things we've got to look at. Road funding, I think, is critical, and we've got to recognize the fact that we have different kinds of communities here. And so the city of Indianapolis in particular is woefully behind in maintaining its streets. And that's partly because of the financing mechanism of the state tax revenue, it favors the rural communities. I'm into the whole harmless thing. I think we shouldn't take a penny away from the small and rural areas. Just because that's practical, and also maybe it's also fair. But we got to find a way to get more revenue from our highways. And at the same time, as has been pointed out, the shift to electronic vehicles, electric electric vehicle and to hybrids undercuts the revenue from petroleum, which is where we get our much of our highway funding from. So we got a problem. We're shrinking our source of support at the same time we're having places like Indianapolis suffer from getting behind the curve. I think you mentioned the third big topic besides the taxes and the gasoline. What was the third one?
Medicaid funding hole.
Medicaid, yeah, that's an interesting one. I think we're suffering from what's the opposite of sticker shock? Maybe it is sticker shock. I don't know. But suddenly the cost of Medicaid, especially for severely disabled children, went way off. Part because of things we learned during the COVID, part because of money that we had during COVID we no longer have. I think we need to have an adult discussion about what we do for families that are really stressed because of the costs. And at the same time, I think this is being ignored. We appear to be moving in the direction of trying to substitute home care for nursing home care in the elderly population, which is far bigger than these 1,500, 1,600 children who are severely disabled. So we're going to look really carefully at what we're doing and what it's costing and the whole Medicaid system. I, for one, am very, very critical of what's called the Medicaid spend down, where adults nearing retirement age basically get rid of their money so that they can get out of Medicaid. There's a whole industry of lawyers who do that. This is one lawyer who does not look with favor on that industry. And so if we're going to move to the elderly thing, which we seem to be doing, and if that takes off the way that the care for the severely disabled children took off, and it's not the same, if the number of people applying goes way up, we may have another problem. So, yeah, I'm watching that one like a hawk. I'm on the budget committee as an alternate. I'm on the Ways and Means Committee. I hope we maintain these positions. So we're going to spend some serious time on this stuff.
Yeah. Well, I'm scared of anything that Representative Delaney is watching like a hawk. I know he'll have a lot to say on all of this, and I'm excited for it. You know, obviously, all three of these things really are budget matters, so the appropriate time to talk about them is 2025. You know, starting kind of in reverse order, the Medicaid funding hole, kind of this shortfall that was brought up this year. Obviously, there is a lot of work to be done there. That's going to have to be a partnership between the state and, you know, the budget committee, like Representative Delaney said, working with FSSA as an agency, because, you know, a lot of this is, you know, on the agency side. And I've heard a lot of people talk, and like, I've even been on like some shows and stuff where people are trying to simplify this to like a budget matter. And it's not like it's some gate, like necessarily a gaping hole that like just showed up in the budget. There's a lot more to it than that. And so I think the way that has to be addressed, yes, obviously there's going to have to be a budget discussion about it, but a lot of it has to do with like programming through FSSA and how they're going to shift dollars in their own budget as well. So, you know, Representative Delaney was talking about like families with disabled children and that program. Like, there are other programs that are going to require like very close looks to see where we can cut and shift things to address that. I don't want to oversimplify that by like presenting it as if it's just like some, you know, line item in the budget that we can just be like, okay, here, we're going to fill that, you know, with the general fund. It just doesn't really work like that. So I don't have the answer to it, but I think, you know, just reminding people that it's not just, let's take $1 billion from the general fund and plug that hole and we're good to go. That's just not really how it works. So I hope people continue to follow it, because there will be, you know, impacts on different programs and stuff like that. I'm sure everyone involved will be taking a very strategic look at where those dollars can be shifted to have the best outcomes for folks. But it's just, I don't want to oversimplify it by like making it look like it's just a budget hole to be plugged. Regarding the road funding formula, I think this is a very appropriate, well, just statutorily, it is the time that we have to talk about it, because things are ending from the last big road funding overhaul. It's also timely to talk about it for reasons that Representative Delaney said. You know, we've seen different federal regulations come out related to the use of electric vehicles and hybrids and stuff like that. It's also going to be interesting to see what happens with the presidential election on this piece, because those regulations could change. They've actually already started to pull back on some of those EV regulations through the Biden administration because there was so much pushback on them up front. Obviously, that's not the whole source of this conversation, but it's definitely a piece of it. And seeing like the outcome of the presidential election will be interesting, because that's definitely going to play like a part in this discussion. And like Representative Laney said, the whole discussion between rural communities and urban communities that have different needs related to the roads, and finding the right balance in the source of funds to be dedicated for roads and transportation and infrastructure fixes. So I think that will be a critical conversation, maybe not like the most exciting discussion, but it's going to be huge, especially for cities like Indianapolis that, like Representative Delaney said, just need the overhaul. And then the tax reform discussion. Okay, so I have heard, you know, in Republican circles for years, the discussion about eliminating the income tax, whether or not that makes sense. I think this is going to be a very interesting conversation for a new governor to be a part of as well, because there are a lot of different positions on this, even within, like, you know, the Republican side and the Democrat side. I think there are different opinions in both of those circles too. Like, you know, Representative Delaney brought up property taxes, and we've done a lot, you know, with business property taxes as well in the last several years. What I think is the bottom line on this conversation is that Hoosiers want to see something change. They want to see a break somewhere. Is it in their property taxes? I don't know. Is it in the personal income tax? I don't know. They want to see a break somewhere. And I think that that is going to be a burden on the legislators in 2025 to figure out where that's going to come from. I think the theme we see in all three of these things is that these are all major spend items for the state of Indiana, and it's going to require creativity on where those dollars come from. Now, I'll just do a little personal plug here, because I happen to be somebody who represents an industry who loves to give money to the state of Indiana, which is the gaming industry. You know, we could do something like Pass iGaming, which would give hundreds of millions of dollars in the future to the state of Indiana. There are other potential revenue streams out there that I think the state would be very wise to consider. And, you know, while that was a personal plug for my clients, I think there are options out there that the state should consider when it comes to bringing more dollars in the door, so that they have the opportunity to discuss things like major tax reform and where these road funding dollars are going to come from and backfilling $1 billion Medicaid shortfall. We have to be willing at some point to say, okay, let's take a step into the future when we have an opportunity to bring all these funds to the table and do something productive with them. So I think continuing to shut down progress like that is not productive, because there is an opportunity to create better outcomes for Hoosiers. So I hope you like that I'm being critical of the current way things are going, Representative Delaney, because I will be the first to say, you know, we've got to take steps to do stuff like that hasn't happened so far. We can't be afraid of these conversations forever. And I hope that leadership and whoever is the new governor going into 2025 will be more willing to have conversations about revenue generating opportunities for the state of Indiana, because obviously we could benefit from it.
Well, I'm a great supporter of sin taxes.
Me too.
Not sin tax, it's S-I-N-S-T-A-X.
Right.
An example nobody ever talks about, but I think our alcohol taxes could be increased.
Yeah.
That would be beneficial. Our cigarette taxes are a joke. And I do not understand the reluctance to raise that. So those are easy existing taxes that we just turn the dial and we can make a big difference.
Yeah.
We have three legs on this stool, basically. There is things like gaming and alcohol, but the basic three props of our system are the property tax, the income tax, the sales tax. Now, the property tax is locally generated, and it's a problem. I think we're going to have to look at shifting state money to support property tax or to substitute for it. We're lucky to be in a good economic period. Some people don't see it, but this is, to some extent, nearly a boom, boom time. Okay. So we're getting very substantial money out of our income system. But I don't want to knock any one of those three props out from under the system, because we'd be in deep trouble. And that's why it's interesting that conservative national experts came in. They didn't really suggest that we get rid of any part of our tax system. I think you want to have people to feel it, which is, I think, what the Republicans are driven by, and I'm driven by this. Property tax is probably the one people feel the most. The sales tax, we're used to it. We pay it on everything except services. Of course, the income tax, our rate is relatively low. Cutting our rate by a tenth of a percent makes very little difference to anybody. But the property tax, you get a bill in the mail. It's for hundreds or more likely thousands of dollars. And it affects people. It affects where they live. It affects their wallet. It affects their planning. The fact that that property insurance is going up dramatically for lots of reasons. So when they look down at their house situation, they say, oh my God, my interest rate went up. My property insurance went up. Give me a break. So that's probably the right place to give a break. Then we're going to have to figure out how to backfill wherever that money went. You know, and I wouldn't pick gaming as the top of my list, but I'd have an aversion. It's not about to change. It's not a moral objection. It's more complicated than that. It's a political objection. But we do need to look. I think Ali's right to mention that, okay, where would you replace any money that you saved from property sales or income tax? I think the idea that we're going to have a tax on services, talk about keeping the lawyers busy. Every lawyer in the state will be down at the state house, along with every doctor and every barber, if we start charging sales tax for services. I don't think that's going to get anywhere. It may be true that some states have it, won't happen here, I don't believe. So what's left that's going to make a big difference is the property tax. And then we have to figure out where it goes. We used to send money to the locals to cover for property tax shortfalls. We can do this. There's mechanisms for this. That, by the way, is the kind of local control the local governments really want. They want to control our state money. They can spend however they want. Oh, they'd love that. They would trade a lot of other interference for that, right? Yeah. I think that's the one thing they most like, right?
Yeah, and in all seriousness, like, you know, we talk about sin taxes and it's like kind of a joke on my part, kind of not, because, you know, if we have these opportunities, like I said, you know, like iGaming is the example I go to because that's my client's interest. But in all seriousness, we have studies that say that will yield hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue to the state. And that's not on the backs of every Hoosier then. It's on the backs of people who choose to partake in entertainment like that. And there's a million other, you know, there's a million other things you could talk about in that way. But sin tax in particular, like Representative Delaney was saying, you know, then we're just raising a tax on people who are, you know, exercising their own freedom to participate in those things. And number one, I think we should all be supportive of individual choices to do things like that in a regulated manner with consumer protections and everything else. I think that's a Republican ideal, actually, is, you know, independent freedom, individual liberty.
We've passed the Democrats put the gaming industry in this.
Yeah. I'll give you full credit.
So we don't have a hang up. I think the interesting one is marijuana.
Sure.
Which I think there's only one thing between us and having legalized marijuana, and that is the federal law that says these are highly scheduled, highly dangerous drugs. That's got to change. Mm-hmm. I don't know why it doesn't change. It's to me stunning. But until that changes, our state tends to be cautious. We don't want to get out in front on these things. And so
it's another great example. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a serious amount of money, and it's going across the state border. So
100%.
Yeah, I think, Ali, unfortunately for the committee, the Republican tendency tends to be, can we cut a tax?
Right.
In fact, we must. We must do that every year. We must have a tax to cut. Let's be rational. Yes, maybe that should be tied with some other thing that enhances our revenue.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a very sound argument, but I don't know that your audience on the Republican side is going to like that.
Yeah, we might not be giving listeners the fireworks they wanted between us because we're agreeing on way too much here. But well, no, it is true, right? Like, why not?
This is a tough thing. Yeah, and we have been one advantage. You know, I'm complimenting people. I guess that's a good thing to do. we have a chairman of the Ways and Means Committee who deeply understands these things and understands the consequences. Yes. We may not have that forever.
Yes.
On the other hand, he's not the kind who wants to do dramatic things for their own sake. So it's a very interesting moment in this context. And I think Ellie mentioned something important earlier that most Democrats like me don't even like to think about it, which is we're likely to have a new governor. I think there is a chance of winning, electing a Democrat. But most people don't think that way. I think there is, because we got a five-way food fight going on the Republican side. How that plays out is we have no precedent for this. This would not have happened. In the past, the state chairman of the Republican Party or the Democrat Party would say, we're not having this food fight. You're the favorite candidate. And shut up. Okay. We're in a different zone, so I don't know how that works. But we're going to have somebody from either party who's going to be dramatically different and will face these kinds of questions on day one in office. So it'll be a very, it'll be an interesting year. Maybe that's why I keep trying to ask my citizens to send me back down there, because it's so damn interesting. Well, enough said.
No, yeah. I mean, and we always appreciate people like yourself with the institutional knowledge too. I think it's important. And like you said, we have a great Ways and Means chair, but I hope that we can continue with the forward thinking, because if we have opportunities to do things like cut taxes for all Hoosiers and backfill it in other creative ways, my only hope is that we can keep an open mind on stuff like that. And hopefully the next governor will be able to do that too.
Interesting, isn't it? The gamblers don't care if they're taxed, and the non-gamblers don't care if the gamblers are taxed. It's a very, it's quite different. You get into the topic of what we should charge for electronic vehicles, electric vehicles, and then you get a whole other thing.
Oh yeah.
One group says gouge him. The other group says no, this is a sacred vehicle. Don't tax it. I mean, it's quite an interesting game. Yeah,
I hope Hoosiers tune in for 2025, because it's going to be a wild ride.
It will be.
Absolutely. All right. Well, that'll do for this week's interview. Ed and Ali, thank you both so much for joining me today. And to our listeners, head over to theindianalawyer.com to hear our past interviews. You can also find us on your favorite podcast apps. We'll talk to you soon.